This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Last fall, I got to sit down with Congressman John Lewis for a conversation at the New Yorker Festival. John Lewis is a hero. He's the last living member of what's been called the Big Six, the leaders of the major civil rights organizations that planned the March on Washington. Lewis was just a kid in the room at that time. He was way younger than Roy Wilkins or A. Philip Randolph and even Martin Luther King Jr. In that fight for civil rights, Lewis was on the front lines. Literally, he survived brutal attacks during the Freedom Rides and in Selma during the March for Voting Rights. So when John Lewis talks about his embrace of nonviolence as a philosophy, as a way of life, he knows better than anyone what that entails, and he's got the scars to show for it.
I'd like to begin because I think there may be some people in this room who have never been to Pike County, Alabama. By asking you to describe your beginnings, just to root us in where you started out, what it was like, your parents, just describe it for us.
I grew up in a very large family, six brothers and three sisters, wonderful mother and a wonderful father, the same community, on the same land that my mother was born on, that my grandfather and my great-grandfather on my mother's side was born on. It was dirt poor. We didn't have running water. We didn't have power. We picked a lot of cotton, pulled corn, gathered peanuts. As a little boy growing up, it was my responsibility on the farm to care for the chickens. And I fell in love with raising chickens. I became very good at raising chickens. as a little child, we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard. And my brothers and sisters and cousins would line the outside of the chicken yard. But along with the chickens, they would help make up the audience, the congregation. I wanted to be a minister. So from time to time, I would talk to the chickens. I would preach to them. And when I look back on it...
Your parents didn't worry about that at all.
No, they really didn't. They thought I was grew up to be a minister, and they thought I was learning by preaching to the chicken, practicing the sermon. So these chickens never quite said amen. But they would bow their heads. They would shake their heads. And when I look back on it, I'm convinced today that some of those chickens that I preached to in the 40s and the 50s tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listened to me today in the Congress. And as a matter of fact, some of those chickens were just a little more productive. at least they produce eggs. I think, to be very frank and candid with you, David, my first nonviolent protest, or protesting against my mother and father, when they wanted to have one of the chickens for dinner. I didn't like it. And so I would boycott the meal. But I didn't like segregation. I didn't like seeing the signs that said white waiting, colored waiting, white men, white women, colored women. And I've asked my mother, asked my father, my grandparents and great-grandparents, they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But in 1955, when I was 15 years old, I heard what happened to Emmett Till. And later during the same year, I think Emmett Till was murdered on August 28, 1965. And then
55. Yeah.
Rosa Parks took her seat on December 1st, 1955. And the action of Rosa Parks inspired me. So in 1956, I was 16 years old with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins. We went down to the public library in the little town of Troy, Alabama, trying to get library cards, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian that the library was for whites only and not for coloreds. I never went back to the Pike County Public Library, not the same building, until July 5th, 1998, for a book signing of my book, Walking with the Wind. Mm-hmm. And hundreds of blacks and white citizens showed up. At the end of the book signing, they gave me a library card.
Now, explain, particularly for people who are younger here, why did the Till case, 1955, have such an electrifying effect on black America and the United States in general, from you to Muhammad Ali to any number of people that became important figures in the civil rights movement?
Well, Emmett Till, this young African-American boy, 15 years old, he was lynched, and there was a trial. They were not convicted. And his mother came down from Chicago, and she said, I want the casket to be open so the world can see what they did to my child. And it had an unbelievable impact.
Those pictures in particular.
Oh, those photographs.
In the black press and in Life magazine.
Yeah. People all over America started protesting about what happened to this 15-year-old child.
And yet you were a very young person at that time.
I was 15.
And eventually, not that long after, you go to Fisk and you become involved in actions of civil disobedience and passive resistance.
By the fall of 1959, we started studying the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. We studied the great religions of the world. We had a wonderful teacher, a young man by the name of Jim Lawson, who was a pacifist, who get us together every Tuesday night at 6:30 p.m., where we had role-playing, we had social drama.
What would you do in the role-playing sessions?
People spitting on you, beating you, throwing you in jail, knocking you down.
And nothing while you're doing this, and even when the events themselves comes along, strikes you as it does many people today, as absurd, too much to bear.
Many of us as young people during those days accepted the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence as a way of life. We studied what Martin Luther King Jr. was all about in Montgomery. So we were ready, we were prepared. No, if we wanted to redeem the soul of America, if we wanted to what we call create the beloved community, we had to use the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. We accepted the idea that the philosophy of nonviolence is one of those immutable principles that you couldn't deviate from.
No matter what.
You're beaten, yes. Arrested. You're thrown in jail, but you will not hate. You will not become bitter or hostile. You will keep the faith. The first time I got arrested, I should tell you, I felt free. I felt liberated.
Why is that?
I felt like I crossed over because we have been told over and over again, don't get in trouble, don't get in the way. No, it's not a nice thing to go to jail. So during the 60s, I was arrested 40 times for sitting in, or standing in, or marching for the right to vote. And since I've been in Congress, 5 more times. And I'll probably get arrested again for something.
Let's talk about Selma for a moment. This is 50 years ago. When you think of your own self at that age, you were very, very young. You're at the front of the line. What got you there? What put you there? What qualities in you as such a young person had you at the front of the line at this event that even must have seemed momentous even then, not knowing how it would play out down the line?
You know, when I spoke at the March on Washington on August 28, 1963, while I was working on the speech with some of the staffers of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, had been reading a newspaper, and I saw a group of black women in Southern Africa carrying signs and one man, one vote. So in my March on Washington speech, I said something like, one man, one vote is the African cry. It is ours too, it must be ours. I didn't like the fact that my own mother, my own father, my own teachers could not participate in the democratic process, that people were told they could not read or write well enough. And I knew we had to do something about it. So when I became chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, we started working all across the South. Places like Selma, places in Mississippi. There were one county between Selma and Montgomery. Lowndes County was more than 80% African American. There was not a single registered African American voter in the county. We knew we had to do something. We had to find a way to dramatize the issue, to make it real. We had to march on Washington. The Civil Rights Act was passed and signed into law by President Johnson in July 1964. But people still couldn't register to vote in many parts of the South. Three young men, two from New York City, Andy Goodman, Mickey Scherner, a young African-American from Mississippi, James Shaney, who went out on a Sunday night, June 21st, 1964, to investigate the burning of an African-American church to be used for voter registration workshops. These three young men were stopped by the sheriff, arrested, placed in jail, then taken out of jail, turned over to the Klan, where they were beaten, shot, and killed. And we couldn't allow their death to be in vain. We had to insist that the Congress pass a Voting Rights Act.
There seemed to be in you as a young man a tension between your adherence to the principles of nonviolence and your loyalty to Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and then a more radicalizing rhetoric and the movement towards SNCC. And as you know, better than anybody else in this world, there was both an alliance between and a pronounced tension between SCLC and SNCC. And those tensions would grow in the movement and reach an even wider gulf with the rise of Malcolm X, Black Power, and the Panthers. What inner conflicts were you facing as an individual and as a civil rights leader and as a young man in the movement while these questions?
Well, I love and admire Dr. King. If it hadn't been for Martin Luther King Jr., I don't know what would have happened to me. He inspired me. He set me on a path. In 1962, before I became the chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, he invited me to become a member of his board of directors as sort of the liaison between the young people and the adults in the movement. He was almost like a big brother. And I was not going to separate my affection and love for Dr. King. He was my leader. And I could be strong, and I could sound militant, and I could sound radical, but I believe in the way of peace, the way of love. I believe in that we got to have programs, not just a lot of rhetoric, but we have to engage in the 1-2-3s and ABCs of organizing people and organizing a movement and leading a group of people.
Were you made uncomfortable by or worried about things pulling you more to the left, say Stokely Carmichael, who was also in SNCC and a comrade of yours? Describe those tensions and how you look back at them.
Well, I never got caught up in the rhetoric of Black Power, because SNCC, as an organization, we believed in doing something in a programmatic way, not just talking the talk, but mm-hmm. walking the walk.
I've never heard you talk much about Malcolm X and your evaluation of his legacy, both how you felt about him in real time and how you now look back at him and his role in the movement.
Well, I first met Malcolm on the eve of the March on Washington the night of August 27, 1963, and we had a brief discussion.
How did he feel about the March on Washington?
He was not that supportive of the march, and he had some things to say about the march.
What did he say?
Well, he said, in effect, that we allowed President Kennedy to turn the march into a social a picnic or something like that.
That JFK was somehow using you to take the onus off of him.
Take some of the steam.
Yeah.
As you well know, in the beginning, President Kennedy was not that supportive of the march.
Not at all.
When we met with him in June of 1963, he said, if you bring all these people to Washington, won't there be violence and chaos and disorder? We would never get a civil rights bill through the Congress. And after the march took place, and it was so successful, that day, President Kennedy invited us all back down to the White House. He stood in the door of the Oval Office, greeting us. He was beaming like a proud father. He kept saying, you did a good job, you did a good job. And when he got to Dr. King, he said, you did a good job, and you had a dream. That was my last time seeing that.
Did you find that purely joyful or a little patronizing or both from Kennedy's point of view?
No, I thought he was being encouraging and that he was so pleased that everything had gone so well that in his own way, you know, he was the first president in the history of the country when he delivered that speech on June 11, 1963, said the issue raised, the issue of civil rights is a moral issue.
But at the same time, he has J. Edgar Hoover spying on Martin Luther King. So he's double...
I'm not going to try to defend or speak up for President Kennedy, but to be very frank and candid with you, I think a lot of presidents were afraid of J. Edgar Hoover. This man did so much damage.
Have you ever looked at your FBI report?
Oh, yes, I've seen it. Yeah.
What are the highlights?
Well, I just cannot tell you. But, you know, when you get the report, it's just marked out, it's blackened out in there.
Were you grateful for that?
Not really. Yeah. I think the truth, everything should come out. I didn't do anything that was, I thought was illegal or immoral or anything like that. I think this man was obsessed with destroying a movement to liberate all of the American people.
Hoover.
Hoover, yes.
And if I had told you in 1965 that we'd be where we are now, both with a black president, but also with Ferguson, and Staten Island, and everything we know about the dynamics of this country and its inequalities and the nature of institutional racism, whether it's in our schools or in our voting laws, how would you have reacted? Are you so immensely hopeful?
Well, to lose hope is to give up. You have to be optimistic. You have to believe somehow in some way we're going to work it out.
I get that, but look at the institution you work in.
I know, but in spite of it all, we're human. We make blunders. We make mistakes. Now, it's in keeping with the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence that you have to press on.
I have to say, and I mean this with great respect, I think, viewed from outside and even peeking in once in a while as a reporter, the House of Representatives represents one of those French caricatures of the French Assembly, and everybody looks kind of strange and weird and monstrous. And not in front of you. I'm not going to say.
No, that's okay. It's
a show.
Oh.
Nothing gets done. Leaderships don't mean much anymore. You go to work there every day. Do you come home at night and drink yourself to sleep, or what's it like?
Well,
it's
another world. It's another world. I try to be hopeful and optimistic, but every now and then I too have an executive session, quite a few these days, saying why. I've seen, you know, I've been in Congress now for almost 30 years. And I've seen better days.
What's happening? Why is there this talent level, this sense of resentment and anger and fury and inexplicable? We're going to have another school shooting or another mass shooting, sure shooting, in 3 weeks. or in 2 months. God forbid, but it will happen.
Well,
and nothing.
I think you have a group of people who have been elected, and I don't know why they ran for office in the first place. They don't like government, and some of them don't like people.
It's a great combination.
Really. I think that people who go to bed mean, they dream mean. And they get up mean and be mean for the rest of the day until they go back to bed and just mean some more. Saying, who can I hurt today or tomorrow? They don't believe in government.
One of the common T-shirts that I've seen among adherents to and activists for Black Lives Matter is, this isn't your granddaddy's civil rights movement. How would you've obviously met with people, you've seen what's happened, you've seen the use of social media as an organizing principle. Where is Black Lives Matter at this point? What do you admire about it? Maybe what concerns you about it? And what role does it play?
Just last evening, I was in an airport, and a young man came up, and he said, Congressman Lewis, I'm part of Black Lives Matter. So I admire you. I love you. So you're my hero. You and your friends in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in SNCC made it possible for us to exist. And I said, I wish you well. Continue your work.
Do you feel a part of it?
I feel like some of these young people could be my children, or my grandchildren, or great-grandchildren, and maybe they're picking up where we left off, but they're part of an extension of that movement.
Let's look at where they and all of us have to pick up where you have brought us. Voting rights is something that particularly concerns you. Lay out for us where we are with voting rights, what the motivations of the players are, and what the possibilities are.
Well, the Voting Rights Act that was signed into law on August 6, 1965, changed America forever. When Martin Luther King Jr. came back from receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, he had a meeting with President Johnson, and he said to the president in so many words, Mr. President, we need a Voting Rights Act. And Lyndon Johnson said, if you want it, make me do it. He said, we don't have the votes in the Congress to get a Voting Rights Act passed. I just signed a Civil Rights Act. But if you want it, make me do it. So Martin Luther King Jr. joined us in Selma, Alabama, where SNCC had been working since 1962. And the drama of Selma, the drama of Mississippi and other parts of the South, created the climate, created the environment to get the act passed and signed into law on August 6, 1965. 50 years ago. Since then, because of the decision of the United States Supreme Court, that decision put a dagger in the heart of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And many states, not just southern states, but states in the Northeast.
Pennsylvania
is a good example. In the Midwest and all across our country.
Why is this happening? If we've made so much
progress. But things are changing. People are afraid of the future. America is changing.
Be specific. What are they afraid of? Are they afraid of a browner America?
They're afraid of the makeup of America is changing. Just look around. And I don't want to be that partisan about it, but just look around. When Texas become a Democratic stronghold, when the Latino population becomes citizens, and we set people on a path to citizenship, when we have comprehensive immigration reform, people get registered, start voting, America will be a different America. And people shouldn't be afraid, should embrace the future. As the Pope said, we all are immigrants.
Congressman, thank you, and thank you all for coming.
Congressman John Lewis. I talked with him last October at the New Yorker Festival.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.